Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. A study published in the journal Science in the fall of 2019 collected decades of data revealing that nearly a third of all birds, 3 billion creatures, have vanished from North America in the last 30 years. This was yet another piece of bad news in a seemingly endless stream of stories chronicling the loss of habitat, the extinction of animal species, and the fallout from human-induced climate change. Despite this, there is room for optimism. As technology improves, so does our understanding of the life cycle of birds, including their migratory tracks, their physiological adaptations to make the journeys, and the human impediments to their success. The other reason for optimism, the popularity of bird watching. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimates 45 million Americans, that's 20% of the population, birdwatch around their homes. And bird watching isn't just an American pastime, it's global. Ornithologist and naturalist Scott Weidenthal has spent decades researching and writing about birds. He's the author of numerous books. His latest, released just this month, is titled A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. Scott, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mindy. It's a pleasure to be here.
So CAI listeners love birds. We have a weekly bird report feature, a monthly bird news program with Mark Faraday, a science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. We don't have data to support this, but I think we have a higher percentage of birders in our region than elsewhere in the Northeast. So we're really excited to have you here today. So let's start with what got you interested in birds and birding. How long ago was that?
Well, I mean, I describe myself as a museum quality nature nerd, and that was pretty much right out of the womb. I've been interested in birds all my life. I grew up in the mountains of eastern Pennsylvania. I had parents that recognized they had a slightly weird kid and encouraged me in many ways. My mother in particular was very interested in the outdoors. My dad hunted and fished. I got interested in birds from a recreational perspective early on. I was a bird watcher, when I was still a little kid. I got hooked on the science of birds in college when I took an ornithology course. But really the pivotal moment of my life was when I was the fall of the year that I was 12 years old. My parents took me to a place called Hawk Mountain Sanctuary in eastern Pennsylvania. It's the world's first sanctuary for birds of prey. It's this dramatic overlook 1,000 feet above the valley along the Kittatinny Ridge. And every fall, about 20,000 hawks, eagles, falcons, vultures pass Hawk Mountain on their way south. They're migrating south along the ridges of the Appalachians. And, I'd been pushing my parents for a long time to take me up there. And finally, it was like, oh, God, let's just shut them up and take them up there. And it just happened to be the best migration day of the fall. And strong cold front had come through the night before. The sky was full of raptors. And there's this river of hawks and falcons and eagles passing by me. And it got me hooked that day on three things that have been central to my life ever since. I got hooked on the Appalachian Mountains as this great corridor. I mean, I was growing up among these mountains, didn't really understand, the kind of global significance of them. I got hooked on raptors because, with all due respect to all other groups of birds, raptors are the coolest birds. And I got hooked that day on migration. I mean, sitting at the base of this tall pole on which the hawk watchers had put a plastic owl decoy, because hawks hate owls and they'll never pass up an opportunity to dive down and attack one. And watching this blue jay-sized sharp-shinned hawk diving straight toward the owl, straight toward me, getting bigger and bigger and bigger in my binoculars until this thing flashed just a few feet over my head. And then looking through my National Geographic Atlas and figuring out that these birds were coming from Greenland and the Canadian Arctic and on their way to places like Tierra del Fuego and Bolivia and Colombia. Suddenly my 12-year-old world got very much larger that day. And so migration has been one of the defining passions of both my personal and professional life ever since then.
Yeah. Now, you worked for years as a journalist. So tell us about that transformation from a career in journalism to a career in birding. That started with an assignment, right?
It did. And I am not the kind of person you want to invite in for career day, because I had what was could most politely be described as a circuitous career path. I wanted to be a professional herpetologist and then jumped over to a fine art degree in college to be a wildlife artist and kind of failed at that. And ended up writing a weekly natural history column for a local newspaper in eastern Pennsylvania that led to a full-time reporting job. And yeah, one of my assignments there was I pitched the idea to my editor of doing a story about Hawk Mountain's new research program, where they were trapping and radio tagging and following migrant hawks. And I had, again, I've been interested in and passionate about raptors ever since I was a little kid. I, by that point, had been doing raptor rehabilitation, working with injured birds of prey. I was doing raptor education in schools with non-releasable birds of prey. So I had a hands-on experience with raptors. But the idea of basically fly fishing in the sky, luring these birds down out of the sky in their migration and into your nets and catching them and putting a numbered leg band on them or a radio transmitter and following them on their migration, it was the most addictive thing I have ever done. And I got very deeply, very quickly involved in bird banding. And that has led, over the course of the last 25 or 30 years, has led me deeper and deeper into the world of migration research. I don't have an academic science degree, but ornithology is one of the branches of science that has always been most welcoming of committed, passionate outsiders. There's, you know, I am by no means unusual in the world of ornithological science in that I've been doing, you know, serious research for years without that academic background. There's a lot of us like that in ornithology.
Yeah. So you progressed from an amateur birder into a researcher, including getting your license to band hummingbirds. Tell us about that experience of getting up close and personal with a hummingbird. They're so small. I know they're sturdier than we think they are, but I would be so afraid that I would break it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So tell us about that.
And that, in fact, actually, I've done a lot of hummingbird bander training for the Federal Bird Banding Lab. And the hardest thing to teach somebody is that you're not going to break them if you just breathe on it, because they look like they're, you know, made out of spun glass, but they're actually the junkyard dogs of the bird world. Hummingbirds are tough little beasts. And my particular interest are Western species of hummingbirds that are showing up in increasing numbers in the Northeast and the East. And what we're actually seeing, this is really cool, is we're seeing the evolution of a new migratory route and a new wintering area for a number of species of Western hummingbirds right before our eyes. So species like rufous hummingbirds that breed in the Pacific Northwest and normally winter in the mountains of Western and Central Mexico. Well, because migration is not a learned behavior, it's not something that mom and dad are teaching to the kids. It's a genetically imprinted set of instructions that a bird is born with, and anything genetic is subject to mutation. So within every generation of birds, there's a few that go in the wrong direction. And I think this has been going on as long as there have been rufous hummingbirds, but 400 or 500 years ago, the climate was much colder, the landscape was much different. Those birds probably were out of the gene pool, they probably died. But now, with warming climate, with changes to the environment, especially in the East and the Southeast, it's like the land of milk and honey now for a hummingbird in the wintertime down in the Gulf Coast. These birds are showing up in the East. They're showing up in New England in October and November. They're slowly pushed farther and farther south by cold weather, so that by winter they're down in the Gulf Coast. They spend the winter there. They fly back to the Pacific Northwest. And they pass those once faulty genes on to a new generation. So every year there's more and more hummingbirds making this trip. And you're right. I mean, we think of these as delicate, delicate little birds. But I mean, these are birds that can tolerate sub-zero temperatures. These Western hummingbirds actually can go into hibernation every night, turn their thermostat down dramatically, wake up in the morning, shivering, using muscular shivering to bring their body temperature back up to 104 degrees where it belongs, and boom, off they go for the day. And I hold one of these things in my hand that was probably born in southeastern Alaska or British Columbia. For example, last year I banded the first Anna's hummingbird from the West Coast. It's been found anywhere in New England. Found that in northern New Hampshire in November after the first heavy snowfall. And she was still fat and happy up there. That is not a difficult environment for a hummingbird like that.
Yeah. I have a brother-in-law that lives in Colorado. And when we were out there, I was looking, the neighbor had a hummingbird feeder. And I'm thinking, how are these hummingbirds? I mean, they love it there, right? You think that, it can be snowing one day and then it's warm the next day and that weather kind of fluctuate all the time. But yeah, you're right. They're tough little things.
Oh yeah. I mean, rufous hummingbirds now breed as far north as central Alaska. You can find rufous hummingbirds in Fairbanks. They arrive back in Alaska in April when there's still 3 feet of snow on the ground. I mean, they're adapted to those kind of cold environments. So we don't give them nearly the credit that we do.
You also headed up a project, Project Snowstorm, which tracks snowy owls. And we had a number of sightings of snowy owls on the Cape in recent years. Tell us a little bit more about that project and why it was started.
Yeah, this was a completely accidental project. I mean, usually when you design a scientific study, you spend years you know, setting up the parameters and finding funding for it. And what happened in the winter of 2013-2014, we had the largest invasion of snowy owls into the eastern United States and southern Canada since at least the 1920s and maybe as far back as the 1890s. And when a couple of us realized the magnitude of what was going on, as a good friend of mine, Dave Brinker from Maryland's Department of Natural Resources said, none of us are going to live long enough to see this happen again. We need to do something to learn more about snowy owls. So we launched Project Snowstorm, which uses high-tech GPS GSM transmitters. So basically they're functioning using two technologies most people are carrying around in their pockets right now. They communicate with the GPS satellite system overhead, and they record incredibly precise three-dimensional GPS locations, altitude, latitude, longitude, flight speed, maybe it's four-dimensional. And then once or twice a week, they dial up through the cell phone network and they send us that data cellularly. So I like to joke that I get text messages from snowy owls because my friends are cooler than your friends. And over the years, and this is an entirely crowdfunded project. We're supported strictly by small donations from the public. We've been able to tag more than 90 snowy owls in 17 states and provinces from Alaska to Maine and as far south as the Delmarva Peninsula. It's grown rapidly into the world's largest study of the winter migration and movement ecology of snowy owls. And if folks are interested, they can go to www.projectsnowstorm, all one word, .org. And all of the tracking data from all of those snowy owls is available on there. We have interactive maps. People can see where these owls have gone. You know, we've worked closely with my good friend Norman Smith, recently retired from Mass Audubon, who's been studying snowy owls at Logan Airport for years. And a bunch of the owls that we've tagged, Norman has relocated from Logan out to Cape Cod, and we've had them on Cape Cod and out on the island. So you can see where some of those owls have been.
Describe how you capture and tag the owls and what kind of data you get from the tags and how often it's updated or made available to you.
Mm-hmm, sure. Well, I mean, a lot of bird banders will use mist nets, where like really, really fine nets to catch birds. Snowy owls wouldn't even notice a mist net. So we have to use a somewhat more muscular approach to catching them. So, you know, for example, I'll use a bow net, which is like imagine a mouse trap that's 4 feet wide and, you know, and 7 feet long, hinged in the middle with netting on it, with a small cage with a couple of gerbils in there. And it's okay. The gerbils are not hurt. In fact, the gerbils are household pets when they're not working on this project. And this, you know, snowy owl comes in, tries to get a gerbil for dinner. And the next thing you know, it's sitting under the net and wondering and no longer worrying about the gerbil. I can tell you that. The transmitter goes on with a little backpack harness. It goes around the bird's wings and the transmitter sits in the middle of the bird's back. It's solar powered, so it can last for years. And we can collect data as frequently as every 6 seconds using these transmitters. Now, it's usually more like an interval of about every 15 minutes. And then, as I said, you know, three or four times a week after storing this information, it dials up to the cell network, sends us the data. And what it's showing us is a lot of the common perceptions people have, a lot of the common assumptions about snowy owls that birders in particular have are wrong. I mean, birders see them out there sitting in the middle of a dune field or along the coast in the daytime, blinking in the sun and assume that they're diurnal. We can see from our tracking data, they do most of their hunting and most of their movements at night. And in fact, when people keep disturbing them during the daytime, that's not particularly good for these owls. We've seen that, you know, many of these owls, even though they're roosting on land, are doing much of their hunting out over open water. I mean, that's something Norman noticed at Logan years ago using night vision binoculars, that a lot of these snowy owls are hunting for seabirds like, you know, auks and ducks and grebes and gulls and birds like that over open water. And yet you'll have another owl just a short distance down the beach that does all of its hunting over land, hunting for rats and mice and voles and rabbits and other land animals. These birds are highly individualistic. And in fact, that's been one of the most fascinating aspects of the study, is to see how each of these owls, their behavior and their approach to living their life as a predator differs from every other owl. They're very, very individualistic.
We looked at the Project Snowstorm website and read more about an individual named Sandy Neck, a snowy owl who was on the vineyard in the Cape in the winter of 2014 and 15. She drowned. How common is this, and how did you recover the tag?
Well, there was a tremendous nor'easter that came blowing up. This was in March of 2014. Tremendous nor'easter with hurricane force winds came blowing up the New England coast. And Sandy Neck was a juvenile snowy owl. She was on her first migration, and she decided to fly across the harbor at Martha's Vineyard in, you know, with enormous waves and 80-mile-an-hour winds. She made a bad decision. We also, that same night, we lost another owl up in Gloucester Harbor under exactly the same circumstances, and we know of at least three other unbanded, untagged snowy owls that drown along the Massachusetts coast during that same storm. All of them were young birds. I suspect young birds make bad decisions. An older, more experienced adult snowy owl probably would have known enough to hunker down and just stay there. In the case of Sandy Neck, a beach walker actually found her washed up on the beach and initially assumed it was one of Dr. Rob Beauregard's tagged ospreys, which Rob's been studying ospreys out on Martha's Vineyard for years, because you know, she was pretty bedraggled at that point. But he sent a picture to Rob. Rob said, "That's a snowy owl. It must be one of Project Snowstorm's birds." So, yeah, it was a shame. We've lost a lot of them over the years from, but mostly from accidents involving people. They get hit by cars. They get hit by planes. They get electrocuted. They eat poisoned rats. You know, there's a lot of dangers out there for snowy owls. And one of the reasons that we're studying them is to understand that threat landscape a little bit better and figure out ways to try to mitigate it so fewer snowy owls die from human interactions.
I think a lot of people remember that 2014, 2015, when we had, you know, so many snowy owls. Do we know what caused them to come to this region? And you know, you said it's not something we're likely to see again for a while. So what caused that?
Right. So snowy owls, about every 4 years on average, we get an unusually large pulse of snowy owls coming south into the Northeast. It's what's known as an eruption. And the old assumption was that these were starving snowy owls that had run out of food up in the Arctic and were forced to come south out of hunger. And it's completely the opposite. They're actually the result of an unusually productive breeding season up in the Arctic the summer before. And that's because the populations of lemmings, these little hamster-like rodents, had reached one of their cyclical peaks, which happens on average about every 4 years. This past winter, we had a modest eruption of snowy owls into the Northeast because there was a major breeding event in the northern Ungava Peninsula of Quebec and adjacent areas in the eastern Canadian Arctic, places like Baffin Island and Bylot Island. Lots of lemmings, lots of nesting snowy owls. They gather in those areas. They have lots of babies. And then when we have these eruption years, it's mostly young snowy owls on their first migration that are coming south. We've tagged a lot of those birds and followed them in subsequent years, and they continue to come south most years, but they tend not to come quite as far south. A lot of our owls that we've tagged in previous years along the New England coast, now when they come south, they tend to spend the winter along the St. Lawrence and Ottawa River valleys in southern Canada or along the north shores of the Great Lakes.
We're talking with Scott Wiedenthal. His new book is A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Scott Wiedenthal. His new book, A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have Marion giving us a call from East Orleans. Hi, Marion.
Hi. I just wanted to call in. I had an observation this morning. We saw what I believe would be a red-tailed hawk that had caught a crow, and all of the other crows were cawing at it and yelling at it in the tree. Yeah. And it woke us up this morning.
Yeah, those crows can be pretty noisy even when a hawk hasn't caught one of them. Seems like an increase in the red-tailed hawk population, Scott. Is that pretty much true in New England, or what's going on there?
Yeah, Red-tailed hawks are certainly doing well. And now you can understand why, when you see crows mobbing hawks and chasing them around, that they're doing it for a reason. You'll see crows mobbing red-tailed hawks. Then you'll see grackles mobbing crows because the crows will raid the grackle nest. And then you'll see robins mobbing grackles because grackles will rob the robin nest. you know, it just keeps going down farther and farther and farther down the food chain there. But yeah, crows, you know, they get caught by red-tailed hawks during the day, but their real enemies are great horned owls at night. And if you really want to hear crows raise a ruckus, if you find a flock of crows finds a great horned owl roosting in the daytime, they will draw in hundreds of crows from, you know, from all directions, and they'll sit there and just make that owl's life absolutely miserable.
Here's the enemy over here. Yeah,
that's right. Well, I mean, it's a little bit of you rob the predator of the element of surprise, because now they can't do anything to hurt you.
Right. Marianne, thanks for the phone call. You're also the founder of the Critical Connections Project, which is using next generation tracking technology to study the migration of birds on national parklands in Alaska. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, this is really cool. I've been working with my good friend, Carol McIntyre, who's the she's a famous golden eagle biologist at Denali National Park in Alaska, and Dr. Ian Stenhouse from the Biodiversity Research Institute up in Portland, Maine. And yeah, we've been working primarily in Denali National Park in central Alaska for about the last 7 or 8 years, using, like for example, tiny, tiny little data loggers called geolocators that weigh a fraction of a gram that we can put on fairly small birds like warblers and thrushes, and catch them in Alaska, put the geolocator on there, let the bird go, it flies off, does its annual migration to Central or South America. And when it comes back the next year, we can catch that bird again, take off the geolocator and download the data and find out in rough terms where that bird has been. And we've never really had the opportunity until just a few years ago to be able to track small birds of that size across long distances. You know, we've had satellite transmitters for years, the kind of transmitters we use on snowy owls. They're way too heavy to put on a small songbird. And so for most migratory birds, we still have almost no idea where they go and what routes they follow. And so, you know, what we're trying to do in the case of the Critical Connections Project is figure out where those connections are, because some of the birds in the 6 million acre wilderness park, where the land is about as well protected as anywhere in North America, some of those species of birds are declining. And we assume the problems are occurring outside of the park on their migration to their wintering grounds. So we're trying to figure out where these birds are going. Now, that means that we're working in grizzly bear country. we've had some interesting encounters with grizzly bears over the years. Although frankly, we're just as worried about moose, because a female moose with a newborn calf can be just as dangerous as a grizzly bear. But it's been an incredible privilege to work in the middle of this astounding wilderness area year after year. You know, we get up at 1 o'clock in the morning because we have to be out in the field at daybreak, which happens at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning in the middle of the summer in the subarctic of Alaska. But you know, we encounter caribou and wolves, and you know, it's an amazing place to work, and then to see the information that we're getting from these birds, to watch these tracks unspool on your computer screen, you know, across a Google Earth globe, these, you know, glowing green lines showing, you know, that the great cheek, the Swainson's thrush that you just caught traveled 8,000 miles back from the borderlands between Argentina and Bolivia. And it's, you know, this little bird that weighs, you know, not a whole lot more than air, making these astonishing flights back year after year from some of the most remote wilderness areas in South America to some of the most remote wilderness areas in North America. And to sit there and hold that bird in your hand is a very humbling experience.
So what are the species that you're tracking, and why are they of interest?
Well, so we're looking at 7 or 8 species. We're looking at a number of thrushes, Swainson's, great-cheeked, and hermit thrushes, a couple of species of warblers, blackpoll warblers, arctic warblers, and Wilson's warblers, and fox sparrows. And all of those are species that live in young, scrubby, fairly new forest or in willow thickets. And those are habitats that are increasing dramatically in central Alaska as the climate warms. It's what scientists call shrubification. What had been open tundra is turning into these shrub habitats. So some of those birds, like hermit thrushes and Swainson's thrushes, are doing really well. Their populations are increasing dramatically in Denali. On the other hand, Wilson's warblers, one of the most abundant birds in the park, their populations have dropped by more than half in the last 30 years. So just trying to understand how the interplay of habitat change and climate change in the park is affecting these birds and what's happening outside. But we chose the name Critical Connections for two reasons. We're drawing connections, obviously, between the park and where these birds are going, but we're also trying to draw connections between these birds and the places from which the visitors to the park are coming. Because it turns out the birds that breed in central Alaska spread out over about three quarters of the Earth's surface every year on their migrations. So whether people are coming to the park from Asia or North America or South America, even Africa, there are birds that breed in Denali that are going back to their home countries, to their home states to spend the winter. So we're trying to make that sense of migration real for the people who are coming to Denali National Park, Wrangell St. Elias National Park, some of these other national parklands in Alaska.
And we're learning so much when you think about, you know, we're talking about technology, but also the things that we're learning and the importance of vision. You write, it now appears that birds may visualize the Earth's magnetic field through a form of quantum entanglement, which is just as bizarre as it sounds.
Yeah, this is the part of quantum physics that even Einstein thought was too bizarre, which is saying something. We've known since the 1850s that birds have a magnetic sense, that they use it for orienting and navigating when they're migrating. But it's always been a mystery. And we've known since like the middle of the 20th century that it involves vision in some fashion. But it wasn't until fairly recently that scientists have finally confirmed that birds are using a form of quantum physics, as you say, known as quantum entanglement. And look, I'm not a quantum physicist. This stuff is hard for me as a layman to wrap my head around. But basically it's the same form of quantum physics that's going to eventually produce unhackable quantum computers and theoretically faster than light communication. And it's happening in the eye of any migratory bird. They're essentially what they're able to do is they're flying through the Earth's magnetic field. There are pigment molecules in their eye that are quantumly entangled that are creating palettes of color that allow the bird to see the Earth's magnetic field and the dip strike angles of these, you know, arching fields of magnetism that are coming out of the Earth's core. You know what I would give to be able to see that? You know, any song sparrow hopping around in your backyard or Canada goose flying overhead is apparently able to do that. Yeah. What we think of as science fiction has been bird fact for a long time.
For a long time, yeah. They are really, when you think about it, amazing little creatures. I want to read something else you wrote. You write, birds can bulk up with muscle mass without exercising. They put on so much fat, in many cases more than doubling their weight in a few weeks, that they are, by any measure, grossly obese, and their blood chemistry at such times resembles that of diabetics and coronary patients, except they suffer no harm. Nor do birds fly nonstop for days suffer from the effects of sleep deprivation. They shut down one hemisphere of the brain, along with that side's eye, for a second or two at a time, switching back and forth as they fly through by the night during the day, and they take thousands of little micro naps lasting just a few seconds. What?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you better believe that human physiologists are paying a lot of attention to this, trying to figure out how we can replicate some of this stuff in humans. You know, the idea of doubling your muscle mass without exercise, man, sign me up for that pill. it's really incredible. I mean, the physiological abilities of migratory birds just beggars the imagination. You know, a couple of years ago, somebody broke the 4-hour record for running a marathon and was hailed as superhuman, which is true, but you know, a little semi-pommated sandpiper taking off from the coast of Nova Scotia or northern New England will fly the equivalent of 126 consecutive marathons, flying 3,300 miles from there to the northeastern coast of South America. This thing's 6 inches long and weighs barely an ounce. So that 4-hour marathoner may have been superhuman, but they're distinctly subavian. What birds can do just absolutely beggars the imagination.
Yeah. One of the places you write about in your book is the vast tidal mudflat along the coast of the Yellow Sea. Describe where the Yellow Sea is and what brought you to these mudflats.
Right. So the Yellow Sea is that body of water that lies between China and the Korean Peninsula. And it is arguably one of, if not the single most important migratory stopover point in the world. Because as you say, the Yellow Sea had the world's largest mudflats. I mean, when the tide goes out there, the tide goes out like 20 or 30 kilometers. I mean, it's just astonishing, vast areas of mud that are rich in marine invertebrates. And every year, tens of millions of migrant birds, including somewhere between 11 and 13 million migrant shorebirds that are drawn from places like New Zealand and Australia and the islands of Oceania, come funneling up through the Yellow Sea. Many of these birds have just flown 6,000 miles nonstop. They land in the Yellow Sea. they only have a couple of weeks to more than double their weight and then continue their migration up into Siberia, the Russian Far East, as far as central Alaska, this enormous, you know, trans-hemispheric migration. And what drew me to the Yellow Sea is not just the importance of the Yellow Sea, but its fragility. China and South Korea in particular have destroyed about 60 or 70% of the Yellow Sea mudflats. And so, you know, this ecosystem on which tens of millions of migratory birds depend really was hanging by a thread. I was there in the spring of 2018 with a group of Chinese and international conservationists that have been struggling mightily for years to try to get the Chinese and Korean governments to preserve what little bit of the Yellow Sea mudflats still remain. And one of them told me, you know, we're down to a birds per hectare equation. For every acre of mudflat now that disappears, there are birds that die because they simply have nowhere else to go. A few years ago, when South Korea built a 21-mile seawall across, basically blocked off about 150 square miles of what had been really rich tidal flats, a fifth of the world's population of a species called great knots that used that spot disappeared. They didn't move somewhere else. They just all died. So, you know, it was looking pretty grim. But just before I got there, a few months before I arrived in China, the Chinese government did what totalitarian governments can do, which is issued this sweeping edict that all further coastal destruction in the Yellow Sea mudflats was to stop immediately. And most, you know, they carved out a few exceptions for, you know, quote, projects of national importance, unquote. But most of the destruction was being driven at the local level. And it was an incredible turnaround at literally the 11th hour. The next year, UNESCO, the World Heritage Program, at China's nomination, declared a dozen and a half or so of the most important sites as UNESCO World Heritage Sites. China actually recently has nominated another dozen or so sites totaling about 600,000 acres for further protection. And so the conservationists that I was spending time with over there found themselves grappling with a very unfamiliar emotion, which was hope. I think just in the nick of time, we have prevented the loss of those remaining mudflats and therefore the loss of those migratory birds.
Now, you and your colleagues are trying to spot spoonbills in the mass of birds descending on the mudflats to feed. Describe that experience.
So the spoon-billed sandpiper is the funkiest, craziest, most weirdly charismatic shorebird in the world. They're the size of a little semi-palmated sandpiper like we see along Cape Cod every year. They're about 6 inches long, but they have this strange flattened spatulate spoon bill. We don't really even know exactly why they evolved it. It helps them in some form in their feeding, but there's only about 400 of them left in the world. They breed in the Russian Far East, they winter in Southeastern Asia, and the Yellow Sea is absolutely critical for them. So I was spending a lot of time looking for spoon-billed sandpipers among these enormous multitudes of birds along the coast. And I have to tell you, I didn't find one. but we would be in places like the mudflats at Dongling, north of Shanghai, and there would just be tens of thousands of shorebirds sweeping past us. I mean, literally just enveloping us in wings, like we were rocks in the middle of a river, you know, these streams of birds flying at shoulder height and parting around us like water pouring around a rock. And landing and feeding with frantic energy. And, you know, we'd be Jing Li, who runs a small nonprofit in China, one of the superb conservationists there. She was desperately trying to sift through these thousands and thousands of birds to find me a spoon-billed sandpiper. And every time she'd say, oh, there's a, and the peregrine falcon would come by and all of this stuff would erupt into flight. I mean, it was an incredible spectacle. She was much more frustrated than I was. I was just mesmerized by the sight. I mean, to see that many birds in one place is always a treat.
Is there tracking technology that would help identify spoonbills instead of trying to locate them by eye?
You'd have to catch the spoonbill and put a transmitter on it, which folks have done, because, you know, we still have not, we know from the number of spoonbill sandpipers that are found on the wintering grounds that there are still significant numbers of spoonbills that are not accounted for in the winter. So they're out there somewhere. But when you're dealing with a bird that is that endangered, you know, scientists are very, very careful about adding anything to that bird that might, you know, even slightly increase it, decrease its chances of survival. So you know, there has been some radio tracking of spoon-billed sandpipers, but in terms of like just making it easy for some schmuck like me from the U.S. to see one and tick it off on our life list, nah, nobody's going to do that.
We're talking with Scott Weidenthal, his new book, A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break.
It was the best show I've ever seen.
The late Vern Locks watching long-tailed ducks on Nantucket.
They're coming, starting over here. They were at 1,000 feet, and I was standing right out on the edge of the beach. They drop, and they tilt from side to side. They slip. And you hear the sound, it's like a freight train over your head. You hear that, and they're, and they were going, I mean, they had to be going 100 miles an hour in the descent. And then they rock right down to the surface of the water. Just, you know, wow.
You're listening to WCAI.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Scott Weidenthal. His new book is A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. I wanted to ask you about long-tailed ducks because, you know, we had this really a lot of them. I mean, they look like clouds of smoke, you know, between Nantucket and going out to Nantucket Sound. And in recent years, there has not been that many. And I know there aren't really all that many places in the world that they congregate like that, right? So what's happened to the long-tailed ducks? Do you know?
I don't actually. I mean, I know long-tailed ducks are a species of conservation concern for a lot of people. You know, I tend to see long-tailed ducks up in the breeding grounds up in Alaska when they look completely different. You know, they molt into that breeding plume. It's completely different than when you see it along the coast of New England. You know, when you're dealing with sea ducks that feed primarily on mollusks, there's a real concern. I mean, with long-tailed ducks, with scoters, with eiders, what the continuing and increasing amount of ocean acidification and the decline in, for example, mussel populations, what that's going to mean long-term for the populations of a lot of these birds. And we, you know, this is where, you know, knowledge is power. And, you know, the kind of technological advances that we've been talking about are coming, I hope, just in the nick of time to finally, you know, allow us to see where these birds are going, what they're doing, the kinds of habitats they're using at a degree of detail that we've never had before. Because, you know, the environment is changing so rapidly at every stage of the migration. I mean, don't forget, long-tailed ducks are breeding in the Arctic, the part of the world where the climate is changing more rapidly than anywhere else. You know, so there may be changes that are driving changes in distribution in the ocean environment along the New England coast, but it may also be changes in weather patterns during their migration season. It may be changes on the breeding grounds in the Arctic. And so, you know, we're kind of in a race against time here to get the information we need to make intelligent decisions to drive conservation choices, you know, where we're going to spend our relatively limited conservation dollars and figure out what species are in the greatest need for the greatest and most immediate attention.
Earlier, we mentioned the study in the journal Science documenting the loss of nearly 3 billion birds in North America over just the last 30 years. That's a staggering number to consider. Explain how they came up with that number.
Well, in part of it, it's this ability to use new technology and particularly computing power that gives us the opportunity in the case of bird populations to actually look back in time. And what I mean by that, since the 1980s, we've had this amazing Doppler radar weather system, 148 Doppler radar sites across the lower 48. And, you know, the National Weather Service put that up there so they could track weather systems, obviously. They did not do it to help ornithology, but it turns out you can watch birds in migration through the night sky on Doppler radar. And the most recent advances in Doppler radar, what's called dual polarization radar, you know, again, the Weather Service came up with this so they could tell ice crystals from water droplets from snowflakes in the atmosphere, but it also means you can distinguish small birds from medium-sized birds from large birds. You can calculate exactly how many birds per cubic meter of airspace are up there. And because we have, like, at this point, hundreds of millions of archived weather radar images every 10 minutes back through time to the early 1980s, with computing power now, we can crunch all of those numbers and look at how bird populations have changed over time on a detailed, quantifiable basis. So, like, for example, we know that every spring, 2.3 billion migratory birds cross over the northern Gulf Coast as they're moving back from Central America and Mexico. We know that over the course of the last 15 years, bird populations have dropped by as much as 27% in spring migration in North Carolina. You start taking all of those data on an annual basis, looking back in time, and, you know, and using also long-term data sets like the Christmas Bird Count and the Breeding Bird Survey and the Western Hemisphere Shorebird Surveys, you know, just a whole host of different databases. Put all those together, and yeah, we've lost, you know, 2.9 billion birds since 1970, basically since I started birding as a kid.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking of the passenger pigeon, right? And lessons learned there. They would darken the sky. There were so many of them, and it's hard to even imagine that species could go extinct.
That's right. Abundance is no guarantee of long-term success. And in fact, one of the mantras that I've tried to live my life as a conservationist by was said years ago by the conservationist Rosalie Yip. She said, the time to save a species is when it's still common, rather than waiting until the last possible moment. And, you know, while we're talking about this 3 billion bird study, I want to point out that there's also, there's a lesson in there that gives us a roadmap for restoration. Because, you know, one group of birds that in the last 40 or 50 years has done extraordinarily well are water birds and wetland birds. Waterfowl, ducks and geese and swans, herons, egrets, ibis, wading birds like that. And the reason for that's no mystery. Starting in the 1980s, when duck populations in North America kind of cratered as a result of drought and bad land use practices, we as a society started pouring a lot of money and resources and political will into preserving and enhancing wetland habitats. And the birds that depend on those habitats came roaring back. So if you look at the group of birds that are in the biggest trouble today, which are grassland birds, we can do the same thing for grassland birds that we did for wetland birds. We just have to have the political will and put the wherewithal into preserving and restoring grassland and prairie and pasture habitats.
We've also learned that building strikes, domestic cats, and light pollution are causing decreases in bird populations. Are there efforts to mitigate these impacts? Certainly,
absolutely.
There's education programs on keep your cats indoors, right?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, yeah. And you can argue about the numbers. I mean, there's the scientists at the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center a couple of years ago calculated that free-running cats in the United States kill between 2 and 4 billion birds a year. That's feral cats, free-running house pets. That ought to be a fairly easy solution. The simple solution is, if you have a cat, please keep it inside. Doesn't matter whether you put a bell on your cat, doesn't matter if you feed your cat, doesn't matter if your cat's spayed or neutered, cats outdoors kill birds. And, you know, window strikes kill a lot of birds, communication towers, and all of those are additive sources of mortality on top of migration, which is already the most dangerous part of the bird's life cycle. But in terms of like building strikes, for example, simply turning off lights on skyscrapers and in urban areas during the peak of the spring and fall migration can be incredibly effective at mitigating that damage. And in fact, increasing numbers of cities, Philadelphia just started this spring, increasing numbers of cities have lights out campaigns where at the peak of the migration in late April and early May here in the Northeast, encourage building owners in cities like Boston and Portland and elsewhere to turn off their lights. It's, you know, it's mostly wasted energy anyway. We've also discovered that because there's so much light pollution in urban areas, especially in fall, when most of the birds migrating south are young birds on their first migration, they tend to get drawn into these urban areas. These are birds that mostly migrate at night, even if they're normally active in the daytime. They evolve to navigate by starlight, and all of that urban light pollution just kind of draws them like moths to a flame. So one of the things that we're realizing is that in addition to getting people to turn off their lights in cities, maybe we ought to be spending more money on restoring and improving bird habitat in urban parks, because, you know, they're going to end up in places like Mount Auburn Cemetery and Central Park in New York and Fairmount Park in Philadelphia. So rather than just managing those areas for people, let's try to manage those areas as well for birds and increase the bird habitat, that we may get more conservation bang for our buck doing that than preserving more pristine areas and more remote wilderness and rural areas.
Marcia in Cumaquid writes, could the author share some of the sites showing the global sites and paths of the migratory species?
Whew. That is a tall order. Because the thing is, We tend to think of bird migration as following like these little narrow corridors. You know, we call them flyways. And certainly there are some corridors that are particularly important for birds. The Appalachian Mountains here in the Northeast are a really important corridor. The Atlantic coastline is a really important corridor. But the fact is, bird migration is universal. Over every square mile of land, over every square kilometer of ocean, there are birds migrating. And to be honest, we don't really understand where most of those birds are going. I mean, that's why we're trying to develop these new tracking technologies. You know, redneck phalaropes, these beautiful little shorebirds that breed in the eastern Canadian Arctic and will migrate south along the coast of New England and the Canadian Maritimes. Until just a few years ago, we had no idea where they went for the winter. We knew they winter at sea, but they've never been seen in large numbers in the Atlantic. The only populations anybody had ever seen were off the Pacific coast of South America. Well, hardly makes sense that birds from the Northeast would be going down there, but it turns out they are. I mean, up until recently, we didn't know what ocean they wintered in. So the number of mysteries still vastly outweighs what we know about bird migration.
We talked a little bit about the advances in technology. Does the technology give you real-time data, or are you always kind of waiting for, you know, information to upload?
It kind of depends on what kind of technology you're using. I mean, for example, you know, the GPS technology that you're using with snowy owls, we're getting that information 3 or 4 times a week. We could actually, frankly, we could program those units to check in a couple of times a day, but it tends to drain the batteries and the solar recharge doesn't keep up with it. With data loggers like geolocators and what are known as pinpoint GPS tags, we have to wait a year until the bird comes back, assuming we can find the bird again, to get that data. So it really depends. There are some, you know, there are some transmitters that can give us almost minute-to-minute data, but those are larger and heavier units, and so they're restricted to the larger and heavier birds that can carry it. We don't want to put anything on a bird that weighs more than about 3% of its body mass. That's a pretty safe upper threshold. And that would be the transmitter, the harness, the leg band, the number of leg band we put on the bird. So it really limits what we can put on each of these, especially small species. Mm-hmm. Now there is a technology. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
I was gonna say there is a technology now called nano tags, which are extraordinarily small radio transmitters. I mean, we're talking small enough to put on a hummingbird, small enough to actually put on migratory butterflies like monarch butterflies.
Wow.
That are monitored by automated receiver stations, what's known as the MODIS Wildlife Tracking System. And I'm involved with an organization right now called the Northeast MODIS Collaboration. We're building out the receiver infrastructure for this worldwide tracking network here in New England. We've done the same thing in the Mid-Atlantic, where we put up about 100 of these receiver stations. We're building another 50 or so in the coming years in New England. And if folks go to www.motus.org, all of the tracking data from all of the birds and bats and butterflies and migratory dragonflies that have been tagged with MODIS are publicly available on there. It's a project being spearheaded by Birds Canada, and it's really revolutionizing our ability to track even the smallest migrants.
Mm-hmm. We'll put a link to the MODIS.org and Project Snowy Owl at our website, capeandislands.org. Just like a minute left. What are some of the big questions that we're still looking to answer in bird migration? There's still a lot, right?
I would love to know, what is the physiological limit of bird migration? I mean, every time we think we have found it, the birds blow right past it. For example, scientists in Europe have discovered that several species of old world swifts, alpine swifts and common swifts, once they leave the breeding grounds in Europe and fly to Africa for the winter, they do not land at all, ever, for like 10 months at a stretch. They are in continuous, nonstop, powered flight. They're sleeping on the wing, they're eating on the wing. We didn't know that until just a couple of years ago. So even the most astonishing things about migratory birds are just tumbling out of the science on an almost monthly basis. So just figuring out what they're capable of doing is the biggest mystery remaining to me.
Scott Wiedenthal, his book is A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. Scott, thanks so much for being with us. What a fun hour this was. Thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it.
It's been a delight, Mindy. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.